This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
What if I told you this holiday season you can stuff your face with tasty, craveable snacks and wait for it, feel great? Hi, I'm Will, founder of IQBar, the only plant protein bar formulated for your body and your brain. IQBar's brain-boosting nutrients are designed to refuel, nourish, and satisfy hunger with zero sugar crash. Featuring delicious holiday flavors like gingerbread, IQBars are the less than 200-calorie snack that satisfies your sweet tooth and your protein goals. Right now, take 25% off all IQBar products and get free shipping. Also, check out our other limited edition holiday flavors like peppermint mocha jitter-free IQ Joe coffee. Clean ingredients, fantastic taste, and zero regrets. Tis the season to refuel smarter, hydrate harder, and caffeinate larger with IQBar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code AUDIO to get 25% off all IQBar products plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code AUDIO.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app.
Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 6 of Alexander's Bridge. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Alexander's Bridge by Willa Sibert Cather. Chapter 6. The last 2 days of the voyage Bartley found almost intolerable. The stop at Queenstown, the tedious passage up the Mersey, were things that he noted dimly through his growing impatience. He had planned to stop in Liverpool, but instead he took the boat train for London. Emerging at Euston at 3:30 in the afternoon, Alexander had his luggage sent to the Savoy and drove at once to Bedford Square. When Marie met him at the door, even her strong sense of the proprieties could not restrain her surprise and delight. She blushed and smiled and fumbled his card in her confusion before she ran upstairs. Alexander paced up and down the hall, buttoning and unbuttoning his overcoat, until she returned and took him up to Hilda's living room. The room was empty when he entered. A coal fire was crackling in the grate, and the lamps were lit, for it was already beginning to grow dark outside. Alexander did not sit down. He stood his ground over by the windows until Hilda came in. She called his name on the threshold, but in her swift flight across the room she felt a change in him and caught herself up so deftly that he could not tell just when she did it. She merely brushed his cheek with her lips and put a hand lightly and joyously on either shoulder. "Oh, what a grand thing to happen on a raw day! I felt it in my bones when I woke this morning that something splendid was going to turn up. I thought it might be Sister Kate or Cousin Mike would be happening along. I never dreamed it would be you, Bartley. But why do you let me chatter on like this? Come over to the fire. You're chilled through." She pushed him toward the big chair by the fire and sat down on a stool at the opposite end of the hearth, her knees drawn up to her chin, laughing like a happy little girl. "When did you come, Bartley, and how did it happen? You haven't spoken a word." "I got in about 10 minutes ago. I landed at Liverpool this morning and came down on the boat train." Alexander leaned forward and warmed his hands before the blaze. Hilda watched him with perplexity. "There's something troubling you, Bartley. What is it?" Bartley bent lower over the fire. "It's the whole thing that troubles me, Hilda. You and I." Hilda took a quick, soft breath. She looked at his heavy shoulders and big, determined head, thrust forward like a catapult in leash. "What about us, Bartley?" she asked in a thin voice. He locked and unlocked his hands over the grate and spread his fingers close to the bluish flame, while the coals crackled and the clock ticked and a street vendor began to call under the window. At last Alexander brought out one word, "Everything." Hilda was pale by this time, and her eyes were wide with fright. She looked about desperately from Bartley to the door, then to the windows, and back again to Bartley. She rose uncertainly, touched her hair with her hand, then sank back upon her stool. "I'll do anything you wish me to, Bartley," she said tremulously, I can't stand seeing you miserable."
"I can't live with myself any longer," he answered roughly.
He rose and pushed the chair behind him and began to walk miserably about the room, seeming to find it too small for him. He pulled up a window as if the air were heavy. Hilda watched him from her corner, trembling and scarcely breathing, dark shadows growing about her eyes.
"It hasn't always made you miserable, has it?"
Her eyelids fell and her lips quivered.
"Always. But it's worse now. It's unbearable. It tortures me every minute."
"But why now?" she asked piteously, wringing her hands.
He ignored her question. "I am not a man who can live two lives," he went on feverishly. "Each life spoils the other. I get nothing but misery out of either. The world is all there, just as it used to be, but I can't get at it any more. There is this deception between me and everything."
At that word, deception, spoken with such self-contempt, the color flashed back into Hilda's face as suddenly as if she had been struck by a whiplash. She bit her lip and looked down at her hands, which were clasped tightly in front of her.
Could you sit down and talk about it quietly, Bartley, as if I were a friend, and not someone who had to be defied?"
He dropped back heavily into his chair by the fire.
"It was myself I was defying, Hilda. I have thought about it until I am worn out."
He looked at her, and his haggard face softened. He put out his hand toward her as he looked away again into the fire. She crept across to him, drawing her stool after her.
"When did you first begin to feel like this, Bartley?"
"After the very first. The first was sort of in play, wasn't it?"
Hilda's face quivered, but she whispered,
"Yes, I think it must have been. But why didn't you tell me when you were here in the summer?"
Alexander groaned. "I meant to, but somehow I couldn't. We had only a few days, and your new play was just on, and you were so happy."
"Yes, I was happy, wasn't I?"
She pressed his hand gently in gratitude. "Weren't you happy then, at all?" She closed her eyes and took a deep breath, as if to draw in again the fragrance of those days. Something of their troubling sweetness came back to Alexander, too. He moved uneasily, and his chair creaked.
"Yes, I was then, you know, but afterward—"
"Yes, yes," she hurried, pulling her hand gently away from him.
Presently it stole back to his coat sleeve. "Please tell me one thing, Bartley. At least tell me that you believe I thought I was making you happy." His hand shut down quickly over the questioning fingers on his sleeve.
"Yes, Hilda, I know that," he said simply.
She leaned her head against his arm and spoke softly.
"You see, my mistake was in wanting you to have everything. I wanted you to eat all the cakes and have them too. I somehow believed that I could take all the bad consequences for you. I wanted you always to be happy and handsome and successful, to have all the things that a great man ought to have, and, once in a way, the careless holidays that great men are not permitted."
Bartley gave a bitter little laugh, and Hilda looked up and read in the deepening lines of his face that youth and Bartley would not much longer struggle together.
"I understand, Bartley. I was wrong. But I didn't know. You've only to tell me now. What must I do that I've not done, or what must I not do?"
She listened intently, but she heard nothing but the creaking of his chair.
"You want me to say it," she whispered. "You want to tell me that you can only see me like this, as old friends do, or out in the world among people. I can do that."
"I can't," he said heavily.
Hilda shivered and sat still. Bartley leaned his head in his hands and spoke through his teeth.
"It's got to be a clean break, Hilda. I can't see you at all, anywhere. What I mean is that I want you to promise never to see me again, no matter how often I come, no matter how hard I beg."
Hilda sprang up like a flame. She stood over him with her hands clenched at her side, her body rigid.
"No!" she gasped. "It's too late to ask that. Do you hear me, Bartley? It's too late. I won't promise. It's abominable of you to ask me. Keep away if you wish. When have I ever followed you? But if you come to me, I'll do as I see fit. The shamefulness of your asking me to do that. If you come to me, I'll do as I see fit. Do you understand? Bartley, you're cowardly."
Alexander rose and shook himself angrily.
"Yes, I know I'm cowardly. I'm afraid of myself. I don't trust myself any more. I carried it all lightly enough at first, but now I don't dare trifle with it. It's getting the better of me. It's different now. I'm growing older, and you've got my young self here with you. It's through him that I've come to wish for you all and all the time."
He took her roughly in his arms. "Do you know what I mean?" Hilda held her face back from him and began to cry bitterly. "Oh, Bartley, what am I to do? Why didn't you let me be angry with you? You ask me to stay away from you because you want me? And I've got nobody but you. I will do anything you say, but that. I will ask the least imaginable, but I must have something."
Bartley turned away and sank down in his chair again. Hilda sat on the arm of it and put her hands lightly on his shoulders.
"Just something, Bartley. I must have you to think of through the months and months of loneliness. I must see you. I must know about you. The sight of you, Bartley, to see you living and happy and successful. Can I never make you understand what that means to me?"
She pressed his shoulders gently.
"You see, loving someone as I love you makes the whole world different. If I'd met you later, if I hadn't loved you so well. But that's all over, long ago. Then came all those years without you, lonely and hurt and discouraged, those decent young fellows and poor Mac, and me never heeding, hard as a steel spring. And then you came back, not caring very much, but it made no difference."
She slid to the floor beside him, as if she were too tired to sit up any longer. Bartley bent over and took her in his arms, kissing her mouth and her wet, tired eyes.
"Don't cry, don't cry," he whispered. "We've tortured each other enough for tonight. Forget everything except that I am here."
"I think I've forgotten everything but that already," she murmured. "Ah, your dear arms." End of chapter 6.
Chapter 7 of Alexander's Bridge. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Alexander's Bridge by Willa Sibert Cather. Chapter 7.
During the fortnight that Alexander was in London, he drove himself hard. He got through a great deal of personal business and saw a great many men who were doing interesting things in his own profession. He disliked to think of his visits to London as holidays, and when he was there, he worked even harder than he did at home. The day before his departure for Liverpool was a singularly fine one. The thick air had cleared overnight in a strong wind, which brought in a golden dawn, and then fell off to a fresh breeze. When Bartley looked out of his windows from the Savoy, the river was flashing silver, and the grey stone along the embankment was bathed in clear, light sunshine. London had wakened to life after 3 weeks of cold and sodden rain. Bartley breakfasted hurriedly and went over his mail while the hotel valet packed his trunks. Then he paid his account and walked rapidly down the Strand past Charing Cross Station. His spirits rose with every step, and when he reached Trafalgar Square, blazing in the sun, with its fountains playing and its column reaching up into the bright air, he signaled to a hansom and, before he knew what he was about, told the driver to go to Bedford Square by way of the British Museum. When he reached Hilda's apartment, she met him, fresh as the morning itself. Her rooms were flooded with sunshine and full of the flowers he had been sending her. She would never let him give her anything else.
"Are you busy this morning, Hilda?" he asked as he sat down, his hat and gloves in his hand.
"Very. I've been up in about 3 hours working at my part. We open in February, you know."
"Well, then you've worked enough, and so have I. I've seen all my men, my packing is done, and I go up to Liverpool this evening. But this morning we are going to have a holiday. What do you say to a drive out to Kew in Richmond? You may not get another day like this all winter. It's like a fine April day at home. May I use your telephone? I want to order the carriage."
"Oh, how jolly! There, sit down at the desk. And while you are telephoning, I'll change my dress. I shan't be long. All the morning papers are on the table."
Hilda was back in a few moments, wearing a long gray squirrel coat and a broad fur hat. Bartley rose and inspected her.
"Why don't you wear some of those pink roses?" he asked.
But they came only this morning, and they have not even begun to open. I was saving them. I am so unconsciously thrifty," she laughed as she looked about the room. "You've been sending me far too many flowers, Bartley. New ones every day. That's too often. Though I do love to open the boxes, and I take good care of them. Why won't you let me send you any of those jade or ivory things you are so fond of? Or pictures? I know a good deal about pictures." Hilda shook her large hat as she drew the roses out of the tall glass. "No, there are some things you can't do. There's the carriage. Will you button my gloves for me?" Bartley took her wrist and began to button the long gray suede glove. "How gay your eyes are this morning, Hilda." "That's because I've been studying. It always stirs me up a little." He pushed the top of the glove up slowly. "When did you learn to take hold of your parts like that?" "When I had nothing else to think of. Come, the carriage is waiting. What a shocking while you take." "I'm in no hurry. We've plenty of time." They found all London abroad. Piccadilly was a stream of rapidly moving carriages, from which flashed furs and flowers and bright winter costumes. The metal trappings of the harness shone dazzlingly, and the wheels were revolving discs that threw off rays of light. The parks were full of children and nursemaids and joyful dogs that leaped and yelped and scratched up the brown earth with their paws. "I'm not going until tomorrow, you know," Bartley announced suddenly. "I'll cut off a day in Liverpool. I haven't felt so jolly this long while." Hilda looked up with a smile, which she tried not to make too glad. "I think people were meant to be happy a little," she said. They had lunch at Richmond, and then walked to Twickenham, where they had sent the carriage. They drove back, with a glorious sunset behind them, toward the distant gold-washed city. It was one of those rare afternoons when all the thickness and shadow of London are changed to a kind of shining, pulsing, special atmosphere, when the smoky vapors become fluttering golden clouds, nacreous veils of pink and amber, when all that bleakness of gray stone and dullness of dirty brick trembles in aureate light, and all the roofs and spires and one great dome are folded in golden haze. On such rare afternoons, the ugliest of cities becomes the most beautiful, the most prosaic becomes the most poetic, and months of sodden days are compensated for by a moment of miracle. "It's like that with us Londoners, too," Hilda was saying. "Everything is awfully grim and cheerless, our weather and our houses and our ways of amusing ourselves. But we can be happier than anybody. We can go mad with joy, as the people do out in the fields of a fine Whitsunday. We make the most of our moment." She thrust her little chin out defiantly over her gray fur collar, and Bartley looked down at her and laughed. "You are a plucky one, you." He patted her glove with his hand. "Yes, you are a plucky one." Hilda sighed. "No, I'm not. Not about some things, at any rate. It doesn't take pluck to fight for one's moment. But it takes pluck to go without. A lot. More than I have. I can't help it," she added fiercely. After miles of outlying streets and little gloomy houses, they reached London itself, red and roaring and murky, with a thick dampness coming up from the river that betokened fog again tomorrow. The streets were full of people who had worked indoors all through the priceless day and had now come hungrily out to drink the muddy lees of it. They stood in long black lines, waiting before the pit entrances of the theatres, short-coated boys and girls in sailor hats, all shivering and chatting gaily. There was a blurred rhythm in all the dull city noises, in the clatter of the cab horses and the rumbling of the buses, in the street calls, and in the undulating tramp-tramp of the crowd. It was like the deep vibration of some vast underground machinery, and like the muffled pulsations of millions of human hearts. "Seems good to get back, doesn't it?" Bartley whispered, as they drove from Bayswater Road into Oxford Street. "London always makes me want to live, more than any other city in the world. You remember our priestess mummy over in the mummy room, and how we used to long to go and bring her out on nights like this? 3,000 years, ugh!" "All the same, I believe she used to feel it when we stood there and watched her and wished her well. I believe she used to remember," Hilda said thoughtfully. "I hope so. Now, let's go to some awfully jolly place for dinner before we go home. I could eat all the dinners there are in London tonight. Where shall I tell the driver? The Piccadilly restaurant? The music's good there." "There are too many people there whom one knows. Why not that little French place in Soho, where we went so often when you were here in the summer? I love it, and I've never been there with anyone but you. Sometimes I go by myself, when I am particularly lonely.
Very well, the soul's good there.
How many street pianos there are about tonight? The fine weather must have thawed them out. We've had 5 miles of Il Trovatore. They always make me feel jaunty. Are you comfy and not too tired?
I'm not tired at all. I was just wondering how people can ever die. Why did you remind me of the mummy? Life seems the strongest and most indestructible thing in the world. Do you really believe that all those people rushing about down there, going to good dinners and clubs and theaters, will be dead some day and not care about anything?
I don't believe it, and I know I shan't die, ever. You see, I feel too powerful.
The carriage stopped. Bartley sprang out and swung her quickly to the pavement. As he lifted her in his two hands, he whispered, "You are powerful."
End of chapter 7.
Chapter 8 of Alexander's Bridge. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Alexander's Bridge by Willa Sibert Cather. Chapter 8. The last rehearsal was over, a tedious dress rehearsal, which had lasted all day and exhausted the patience of everyone who had to do with it. When Hilda had dressed for the street and come out of her dressing room, she found Hugh McConnell waiting for her in the corridor.
"The fog's thicker than ever, Hilda. There have been a great many accidents today. It's positively unsafe for you to be out alone. Will you let me take you home?"
"How good of you, Mac. If you are going with me, I think I'd rather walk. I've had no exercise today, and all this has made me nervous."
"I shouldn't wonder," said McConnell dryly.
Hilda pulled down her veil, and they stepped out into the thick brown wash that submerged St. Martin's Lane. McConnell took her hand and tucked it snugly under his arm.
"I'm sorry I was such a savage. I hope you didn't think I made an ass of myself."
"Not a bit of it. I don't wonder you were peppery. Those things are awfully trying. How do you think it's going?"
"Magnificently. That's why I got so stirred up. We are going to hear from this, both of us. And that reminds me, I've got news for you. They are going to begin repairs on the theater about the middle of March, and we are to run over to New York for 6 weeks. Bennett told me yesterday that it was decided."
Hilda looked up delightedly at the tall, gray figure beside her. He was the only thing she could see, for they were moving through a dense opaqueness as if they were walking at the bottom of the ocean.
"Oh, Mac, how glad I am! And they love your things over there, don't they?"
"Shall you be glad for any other reason, Hilda?"
McConnell put his hand in front of her to ward off some dark object. It proved to be only a lamppost, and they beat in farther from the edge of the pavement.
"What do you mean, Mac?" Hilda asked nervously.
"I was just thinking there might be people over there you'd be glad to see," he brought out awkwardly.
Hilda said nothing, and as they walked on, McConnell spoke again, apologetically.
"I hope you don't mind my knowing about it, Hilda. Don't stiffen up like that. No one else knows, and I didn't try to find out anything. I felt it even before I knew who he was. I knew there was somebody, and that it wasn't I."
They crossed Oxford Street in silence, feeling their way. The buses had stopped running, and the cab drivers were leading their horses. When they reached the other side, McConnell said suddenly, "I hope you are happy."
"Terribly, dangerously happy, Mac." Hilda spoke quietly, pressing the rough sleeve of his greatcoat with her gloved hand.
"You've always thought me too old for you, Hilda. Oh, of course you've never said just that. And here this fellow is not more than 8 years younger than I. I've always felt that, if I could get out of my old case, I might win you yet. It's a fine, brave youth I carry inside me, only he'll never be seen."
"Nonsense, Mac. That has nothing to do with it. It's because you seem too close to me, too much like my own kind. It would be like marrying Cousin Mike, almost. I really tried to care as you wanted me to, away back in the beginning."
"Well, here we are, turning out of the square. You are not angry with me, Hilda? Thank you for this walk, my dear. Go in and get dry things on at once. You'll be having a great night tomorrow."
She put out her hand. "Thank you, Mac, for everything. Good night."
McConnell trudged off through the fog, and she went slowly upstairs. Her slippers and dressing gown were waiting for her before the fire. I shall certainly see him in New York. He will see by the papers that we are coming. Perhaps he knows it already, Hilda kept thinking as she undressed. Perhaps he will be at the dock. No, scarcely that, but I may meet him in the street even before he comes to see me. Marie placed the tea table by the fire and brought Hilda her letters. She looked them over and started as she came to one in a handwriting that she did not often see. Alexander had written to her only twice before, and he did not allow her to write to him at all. Thank you, Marie. You may go now. Hilda sat down by the table with the letter in her hand, still unopened. She looked at it intently, turned it over, and felt its thickness with her fingers. She believed that she sometimes had a kind of second sight about letters, and could tell before she read them whether they brought good or evil tidings. She put this one down on the table in front of her while she poured out her tea. At last, with a little shiver of expectancy, she tore open the envelope and read, "Boston, February. My dear Hilda, it is after 12 o'clock. Everyone else is in bed, and I am sitting alone in my study. I have been happier in this room than anywhere else in the world. Happiness like that makes one insolent. I used to think these four walls could stand against anything, and now I scarcely know myself here. Now I know that no one can build his security upon the nobleness of another person. Two people, when they love each other, grow alike in their tastes and habits and pride, but their moral natures, whatever we may mean by that canting expression, are never welded. The base one goes on being base, and the noble one noble, to the end. This week has been a bad one. I have been realizing how things used to be with me. Sometimes I get used to being dead inside, but lately it has been as if a window beside me has suddenly opened, and as if all the smells of spring blew into me. There is a garden out there, with stars overhead, where I used to walk at night, when I had a single purpose and a single heart. I can remember how I used to feel there, how beautiful everything about me was, and what life and power and freedom I felt in myself. When the window opens, I know exactly how it would feel to be out there. But that garden is closed to me. How is it, I ask myself, that everything can be so different with me when nothing here has changed? I am in my own house, in my own study, in the midst of all these quiet streets where my friends live. They are all safe and at peace with themselves, but I am never at peace. I feel always on the edge of danger and change. I keep remembering locoed horses I used to see on the range when I was a boy. They changed like that. We used to catch them and put them up in the corral, and they developed great cunning. They would pretend to eat their oats like the other horses, but we knew they were always scheming to get back at the loco. It seems that a man is meant to live only one life in this world. When he tries to live a second, he develops another nature. I feel as if a second man had been grafted into me. At first, he seemed only a pleasure-loving simpleton, of whose company I was rather ashamed, and whom I tried to hide under my coat when I walked the embankment in London. But now he is strong and sullen, and he is fighting for his life at the cost of mine. That is his one activity, to grow strong. No creature ever wanted so much to live. Eventually, I suppose, he will absorb me altogether. Believe me, you will hate me then. And what have you to do, Hilda, with this ugly story? Nothing at all. The little boy drank of the prettiest brook in the forest, and he became a stag. I write all this because I can never tell it to you, and because it seems as if I could not keep silent any longer, and because I suffer, Hilda. If anyone I loved suffered like this, I'd want to know it. Help me, Hilda. B. A. End of chapter 8. Chapter 9 of Alexander's Bridge. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Alexander's Bridge by Willa Sibert Cather. Chapter 9. On the last Saturday in April, the New York Times published an account of the strike complications which were delaying Alexander's New Jersey bridge, and stated that the engineer himself was in town and at his office on West 10th Street.
On Sunday, the day after this notice appeared, Alexander worked all day at his 10th Street rooms. His business often called him to New York, and he had kept an apartment there for years, subletting it when he went abroad for any length of time. Besides his sleeping room and bath, there was a large room, formerly a painter's studio, which he used as a study and office. It was furnished with the cast-off possessions of his bachelor days, and with odd things which he sheltered for friends of his, who followed itinerant in more or less artistic callings. Over the fireplace there was a large, old-fashioned gilt mirror. Alexander's big work-table stood in front of one of the three windows, and above the couch hung the one picture in the room, a big canvas of charming color and spirit, a study of the Luxembourg Gardens in early spring, painted in his youth by a man who had since become a portrait painter of international renown. He had done it for Alexander when they were students together in Paris. Sunday was a cold, raw day, and a fine rain fell continuously. When Alexander came back from dinner, he put more wood on his fire, made himself comfortable, and settled down at his desk, where he began checking over estimate sheets. It was after 9 o'clock, and he was lighting a second pipe, when he thought he heard a sound at his door. He started and listened, holding the burning match in his hand. Again he heard the same sound, like a firm, light tap. He rose and crossed the room quickly. When he threw open the door, he recognized the figure that shrank back into the bare, dimly lit hall. He stood for a moment in awkward constraint, his pipe in his hand. "Come in," he said to Hilda at last, and closed the door behind her. He pointed to a chair by the fire and went back to his work table. "Won't you sit down?" He was standing behind the table, turning over a pile of blueprints nervously. The yellow light from the student's lamp fell on his hands and the purple sleeves of his velvet smoking jacket, but his flushed face and big, hard head were in the shadow. There was something about him that made Hilda wish herself at her hotel again, in the street below, anywhere but where she was. "Of course I know, Bartley," she said at last, "that after this you won't owe me the least consideration. But we sail on Tuesday. I saw that interview in the paper yesterday, telling where you were, and I thought I had to see you, that's all. Good night. I'm going now." She turned, and her hand closed on the doorknob. Alexander hurried toward her and took her gently by the arm. "Sit down, Hilda. You're wet through. Let me take off your coat. And your boots, they're oozing water." He knelt down and began to unlace her shoes, while Hilda shrank into the chair. "Here, put your feet on this stool. You don't mean to say you walked down, and without overshoes?" Hilda hid her face in her hands. "I was afraid to take a cab. Can't you see, Bartley, that I'm terribly frightened? I've been through this 100 times today. Don't be any more angry than you can help. I was all right until I knew you were in town. If you'd sent me a note, or telephoned to me, or anything. But you won't let me write to you, and I had to see you after that letter, that terrible letter you wrote me when you got home." Alexander faced her, resting his arm on the mantelpiece behind him, and began to brush the sleeve of his jacket. "Is this the way you mean to answer it, Hilda?" he asked unsteadily. She was afraid to look up at him. "Didn't you mean even to say goodbye to me, Bartley? Did you mean just to leave me?" she asked. "I came to tell you that I'm willing to do as you asked me. But it's no use talking about that now. Give me my things, please." She put her hand out toward the fender. Alexander sat down on the arm of her chair. "Did you think I had forgotten you were in town, Hilda? Do you think I kept away by accident? Do you suppose I didn't know you were sailing on Tuesday? There is a letter for you there in my desk drawer. It was to have reached you on the steamer. I was all the morning writing it. I told myself that if I were really thinking of you and not of myself, a letter would be better than nothing. Marks on paper mean something to you." He paused. "They never did to me." Hilda smiled up at him beautifully and put her hand on his sleeve. "Oh, Bartley, did you write to me? Why didn't you telephone to me to let me know that you had? Then I wouldn't have come." Alexander slipped his arm about her. "I didn't know it before, Hilda. On my honor, I didn't.
but I believe it was because, deep down in me somewhere, I was hoping I might drive you to do just this. I've watched that door all day. I've jumped up if the fire crackled. I think I have felt that you were coming." He bent his face over her hair. "And I," she whispered, "I felt that you were feeling that. But when I came, I thought I had been mistaken." Alexander started up and began to walk up and down the room. "No, you weren't mistaken. I've been up in Canada with my bridge, and I arranged not to come to New York until after you had gone. Then when your manager added 2 more weeks, I was already committed." He dropped upon the stool in front of her and sat with his hands hanging between his knees. "What am I to do, Hilda?"
"That's what I wanted to see you about, Bartley. I'm going to do what you asked me to do when you were in London. Only I'll do it more completely. I'm going to marry."
"Who?"
"Oh, it doesn't matter much. One of them. Only not Mac. I'm too fond of him."
Alexander moved restlessly. "Are you joking, Hilda?"
"Indeed I'm not."
"Then you don't know what you're talking about."
"Yes, I know very well. I've thought about it a great deal, and I've quite decided. I never used to understand how women did things like that, but I know now. It's because they can't be at the mercy of the man they love any longer."
Alexander flushed angrily. "So it's better to be at the mercy of a man you don't love?"
"Under such circumstances, infinitely."
There was a flash in her eyes that made Alexander's flinch. He got up and went over to the window, threw it open, and leaned out. He heard Hilda moving about behind him. When he looked over his shoulder, she was lacing her boots. He went back and stood over her.
"Hilda, you'd better think a while longer before you do that. I don't know what I ought to say, but I don't believe you'd be happy. Truly I don't. Aren't you trying to frighten me?"
She tied the knot of the last lacing and put her boot heel down firmly.
"No, I'm telling you what I've made up my mind to do. I suppose I would better do it without telling you. But afterward I shan't have an opportunity to explain, for I shan't be seeing you again."
Alexander started to speak, but caught himself. When Hilda rose, he sat down on the arm of her chair and drew her back into it.
"I wouldn't be so much alarmed if I didn't know how utterly reckless you can be. Don't do anything like that rashly."
His face grew troubled.
"You wouldn't be happy. You are not that kind of woman. I'd never have another hour's peace if I helped to make you do a thing like that."
He took her face between his hands and looked down into it.
"You see, you are different, Hilda. Don't you know you are?"
His voice grew softer, his touch more and more tender.
"Some women can do that kind of thing, but you can love as queens did in the old time."
Hilda had heard that soft, deep tone in his voice only once before. She closed her eyes, her lips and eyelids trembled.
"Only one, Bartley, only one." "And he threw it back at me a second time."
She felt the strength leap in the arms that held her so lightly. "Try him again, Hilda. Try him once again." She looked up into his eyes and hid her face in her hands. End of chapter 9.
Chapter 10, an epilogue of Alexander's Bridge. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Alexander's Bridge by Willa Sibert Cather. Chapter 10. On Tuesday afternoon, a Boston lawyer, who had been trying a case in Vermont, was standing on the siding at White River Junction when the Canadian Express pulled by on its northward journey. As the day coaches at the rear end of the long train swept by him, the lawyer noticed at one of the windows a man's head, with thick, rumpled hair. "Curious," he thought. "That looks like Alexander, but what would he be doing back there in the day coaches?" It was, indeed, Alexander. That morning, a telegram from Morlock had reached him, telling him that there was serious trouble with the bridge, and that he was needed there at once, so he had caught the first train out of New York. He had taken a seat in a day coach to avoid the risk of meeting anyone he knew, and because he did not wish to be comfortable. When the telegram arrived, Alexander was at his rooms on 10th Street, packing his bag to go to Boston.
On Monday night he had written a long letter to his wife, but when morning came he was afraid to send it, and the letter was still in his pocket. Winifred was not a woman who could bear disappointment. She demanded a great deal of herself and of the people she loved, and she never failed herself. If he told her now, he knew, it would be irretrievable. There would be no going back. He would lose the thing he valued most in the world. He would be destroying himself and his own happiness. There would be nothing for him afterwards. He seemed to see himself dragging out a restless existence on the continent, Cannes, Hyères, Algiers, Cairo, among smartly dressed, disabled men of every nationality, forever going on journeys that led nowhere, hurrying to catch trains that he might just as well miss, getting up in the morning with a great bustle and splashing of water to begin a day that had no purpose and no meaning, dining late to shorten the night, sleeping late to shorten the day. And for what? For a mere folly, a masquerade, a little thing that he could not let go. And he could even let it go, he told himself. But he had promised to be in London at midsummer, and he knew that he would go. It was impossible to live like this any longer. And this, then, was to be the disaster that his old professor had foreseen for him, the crack in the wall, the crash, the cloud of dust. And he could not understand how it had come about. He felt that he himself was unchanged, that he was still there, the same man he had been 5 years ago, and that he was sitting stupidly by and letting some resolute offshoot of himself spoil his life for him. This new force was not he, it was but a part of him. He would not even admit that it was stronger than he, but it was more active. It was by its energy that this new feeling got the better of him. His wife was the woman who had made his life, gratified his pride, given direction to his tastes and habits. The life they led together seemed to him beautiful. Winifred still was, as she had always been, romance for him, and whenever he was deeply stirred he turned to her. When the grandeur and beauty of the world challenged him, as it challenges even the most self-absorbed people, he always answered with her name. That was his reply to the question put by the mountains and the stars, to all the spiritual aspects of life. In his feeling for his wife there was all the tenderness, all the pride, all the devotion of which he was capable. There was everything but energy, the energy of youth, which must register itself and cut its name before it passes. This new feeling was so fresh, so unsatisfied and light of foot. It ran and was not wearied, anticipated him everywhere. It put a girdle round the earth while he was going from New York to Morlock. At this moment it was tingling through him, exultant, and live as quicksilver, whispering, "In July you will be in England." Already he dreaded the long, empty days at sea, the monotonous Irish coast, the sluggish passage up the Mersey, the flash of the boat train through the summer country. He closed his eyes and gave himself up to the feeling of rapid motion and to swift, terrifying thoughts. He was sitting like this, his face shaded by his hand, when the Boston lawyer saw him from the siding at White River Junction. When at last Alexander roused himself, the afternoon had waned to sunset. The train was passing through a gray country, and the sky overhead was flushed with a white flood of clear color. There was a rose-colored light over the gray rocks and hills and meadows. Off to the left, under the approach of a weather-stained wooden bridge, a group of boys were sitting round a little fire. The smell of wood smoke blew in at the window. Except for an old farmer, jogging along the high road in his wagon, there was not another living creature to be seen. Alexander looked back wistfully at the boys, camped on the edge of a little marsh, crouching under their shelter, and looking gravely at their fire. They took his mind back a long way, to a campfire on a sandbar in a western river, and he wished he could go back and sit down with them. He could remember exactly how the world had looked then. It was quite dark, and Alexander was still thinking of the boys when it occurred to him that the train must be nearing Allway. In going to his new bridge at Morlock, he had always to pass through Allway. The train stopped at Allway Mills, then wound 2 miles up the river, and then the hollow sound under his feet told Bartley that he was on his first bridge again. The bridge seemed longer than it had ever seemed before, and he was glad when he felt the beat of the wheels on solid railroad again. He did not like coming and going across that bridge, or remembering the man who built it. And was he, indeed, the same man who used to walk that bridge at night, promising such things to himself and to the stars? And yet he could remember it all so well. The quiet hills, sleeping in the moonlight, the slender skeleton of the bridge, reaching out into the river, and up yonder, alone on the hill, the big white house. Upstairs, in Winifred's window, the light that told him she was still awake and still thinking of him. And after the light went out, he walked alone, taking the heavens into his confidence, unable to tear himself away from the white magic of the night, unwilling to sleep because longing was so sweet to him, and because, for the first time since first the hills were hung with moonlight, there was a lover in the world. And always there was the sound of the rushing water underneath, the sound which, more than anything else, meant death, the wearing away of things under the impact of physical forces which men could direct but never circumvent or diminish. Then, in the exaltation of love, more than ever it seemed to him to mean death, the only other thing as strong as love. Under the moon, under the cold, splendid stars, there were only those two things awake and sleepless, death and love, the rushing river and his burning heart. Alexander sat up and looked about him. The train was tearing on through the darkness. All his companions in the day coach were either dozing or sleeping heavily, and the murky lamps were turned low. How came he here among all these dirty people? Why was he going to London? What did it mean? What was the answer? How could this happen to a man who had lived through that magical spring and summer, and who had felt that the stars themselves were but flaming particles in the faraway infinitudes of his love? What had he done to lose it? How could he endure the baseness of life without it? And with every revolution of the wheels beneath him, the unquiet quicksilver in his breast told him that, at midsummer, he would be in London. He remembered his last night there, the red foggy darkness, the hungry crowds before the theatres, the hand organs, the feverish rhythm of the blurred, crowded streets, and the feeling of letting himself go with the crowd. He shuddered and looked about him at the poor, unconscious companions of his journey, unkempt and travel-stained, now doubled in unlovely attitudes, who had come to stand to him for the ugliness he had brought into the world. And those boys back there, beginning it all just as he had begun it, he wished he could promise them better luck. Ah, if one could promise anyone better luck, if one could assure a single human being of happiness. He had thought he could do so once, and it was thinking of that that he at last fell asleep. In his sleep, as if it had nothing fresher to work upon, his mind went back and tortured itself with something years and years away, an old, long-forgotten sorrow of his childhood. When Alexander awoke in the morning, the sun was just rising through the pale golden ripples of cloud, and the fresh yellow light was vibrating through the pine woods. The white birches, with their little unfolding leaves, gleamed in the lowlands, and the marsh meadows were already coming to life with their first green, a thin, bright color, which had run over them like fire. As the train rushed along the trestles, thousands of wild birds rose screaming into the light. The sky was already a pale blue, and of the clearness of crystal. Bartley caught up his bag and hurried through the Pullman coaches until he found the conductor. There was a stateroom unoccupied, and he took it and set about changing his clothes. Last night he would not have believed that anything could be so pleasant as the cold water he dashed over his head and shoulders, and the freshness of clean linen on his body. After he had dressed, Alexander sat down at the window and drew into his lungs deep breaths of the pine-scented air. He had awakened with all his old sense of power. He could not believe that things were as bad with him as they had seemed last night, that there was no way to set them exactly right. Even if he went to London at midsummer, what would that mean except that he was a fool? And he had been a fool before. That was not the reality of his life, yet he knew that he would go to London. Half an hour later, the train stopped at Morlock. Alexander sprang to the platform and hurried up the siding, waving to Philip Horton, one of his assistants, who was anxiously looking up at the windows of the coaches. Bartley took his arm, and they went together into the station buffet.
I'll have my coffee first, Philip. Have you had yours? And now, what seems to be the matter up here?" The young man, in a hurried, nervous way, began his explanation. But Alexander cut him short. "When did you stop work?" he asked sharply. The young engineer looked confused. "I haven't stopped work yet, Mr. Alexander. I didn't feel that I could go so far without definite authorization from you."
"Then why didn't you say in your telegram exactly what you thought, and ask for your authorization? You'd have got it quick enough."
"Well, really, Mr. Alexander, I couldn't be absolutely sure, you know, and I didn't like to take the responsibility of making it public." Alexander pushed back his chair and rose. "Anything I do can be made public, Phil. You say that you believe the lower chords are showing strain, and that even the workmen have been talking about it, and yet you've gone on adding weight. I'm sorry, Mr. Alexander, but I had counted on your getting here yesterday. My first telegram missed you somehow. I sent one Sunday evening to the same address, but it was returned to me. Have you a carriage out there? I must stop to send a wire." Alexander went up to the telegraph desk and penciled the following message to his wife. "I may have to be here for some time. Can you come up at once? Urgent. Bartley." The Morlock Bridge lay 3 miles above the town. When they were seated in the carriage, Alexander began to question his assistant further. If it were true that the compression members showed strain, with the bridge only 2/3 done, then there was nothing to do but pull the whole structure down and begin over again. Horton kept repeating that he was sure there could be nothing wrong with the estimates. Alexander grew impatient. "That's all true, Phil, but we were never justified in assuming that a scale that was perfectly safe for an ordinary bridge would work well with anything of such length. It's all very well on paper, but it remains to be seen whether it can be done in practice. I should have thrown up the job when they crowded me. It's all nonsense to try to do what other engineers are doing when you know they're not sound."
"But just now, when there's such competition," the younger man demurred, "and that's certainly the new line of development."
Alexander shrugged his shoulders and made no reply. When they reached the bridge works, Alexander began his examination immediately. An hour later, he sent for the superintendent. "I think you had better stop work out there at once, Dan. I should say that the lower cord here might buckle at any moment. I told the commission that we were using higher unit stresses than any practice has established, and we've put the dead load at a low estimate. Theoretically, it worked out well enough, but it had never actually been tried." Alexander put on his overcoat and took the superintendent by the arm. "Don't look so chopfallen, Dan. It's a nuisance, but we've got to face it. It isn't the end of the world, you know. Now, we'll go out and call the men off quietly. They're already nervous, Horton tells me, and there's no use alarming them. I'll go with you, and we'll send the end riveters in first." Alexander and the superintendent picked their way out slowly over the long span. They went deliberately, stopping to see what each gang was doing, as if they were on an ordinary round of inspection. When they reached the end of the river span, Alexander nodded to the superintendent, who quietly gave an order to the foreman. The men in the end gang picked up their tools and, glancing curiously at each other, started back across the bridge toward the river bank. Alexander himself remained standing where they had been working, looking about him. It was hard to believe, as he looked back over it, that the whole great span was incurably disabled, was already as good as condemned, because something was out of line in the lower cord of the cantilever arm. The end riveters had reached the bank and were dispersing among the tool houses, and the second gang had picked up their tools and were starting toward the shore. Alexander, still standing at the edge of the river span, saw the lower cord of the cantilever arm give a little, like an elbow bending. He shouted and ran after the second gang, but by this time everyone knew that the big river span was slowly settling. There was a burst of shouting that was immediately drowned by the scream and cracking of tearing iron as all the tension work began to pull asunder. Once the cords began to buckle, there were thousands of tons of ironwork, all riveted together and lying in mid-air without support. It tore itself to pieces with roaring and grinding and noises that were like the shrieks of a steam whistle. There was no shock of any kind. The bridge had no impetus except from its own weight.
It lurched neither to right nor left, but sank almost in a vertical line, snapping and breaking and tearing as it went, because no integral part could bear for an instant the enormous strain loosed upon it. Some of the men jumped and some ran, trying to make the shore. At the first streak of the tearing iron, Alexander jumped from the downstream side of the bridge. He struck the water without injury and disappeared. He was under the river a long time and had great difficulty in holding his breath. When it seemed impossible and his chest was about to heave, he thought he heard his wife telling him that he could hold out a little longer. An instant later his face cleared the water. For a moment, in the depths of the river, he had realized what it would mean to die a hypocrite, and to lie dead under the last abandonment of her tenderness. But once in the light and air, he knew he should live to tell her, and to recover all he had lost. Now, at last, he felt sure of himself. He was not startled. It seemed to him that he had been through something of this sort before. There was nothing horrible about it. This, too, was life, and life was activity, just as it was in Boston or in London. He was himself, and there was something to be done. Everything seemed perfectly natural. Alexander was a strong swimmer, but he had gone scarcely a dozen strokes when the bridge itself, which had been settling faster and faster, crashed into the water behind him. Immediately the river was full of drowning men. A gang of French Canadians fell almost on top of him. He thought he had cleared them when they began coming up all around him, clutching at him and at each other. Some of them could swim, but they were either hurt or crazed with fright. Alexander tried to beat them off, but there were too many of them. One caught him about the neck, another gripped him about the middle, and they went down together. When he sank, his wife seemed to be there in the water beside him, telling him to keep his head, that if he could hold out, the men would drown and release him. There was something he wanted to tell his wife, but he could not think clearly for the roaring in his ears. Suddenly he remembered what it was. He caught his breath, and then she let him go. The work of recovering the dead went on all day and all the following night. By the next morning 48 bodies had been taken out of the river, but there were still 20 missing. Many of the men had fallen with the bridge and were held down under the debris. Early on the morning of the second day, a closed carriage was driven slowly along the river bank and stopped a little below the works, where the river boiled and churned about the great iron carcass, which lay in a straight line two-thirds across it. The carriage stood there hour after hour, and word soon spread among the crowds on the shore that its occupant was the wife of the chief engineer. His body had not yet been found. The widows of the lost workmen, moving up and down the bank with shawls over their heads, some of them carrying babies, looked at the rusty hired hack many times that morning. They drew near it and walked about it, but none of them ventured to peer within. Even half-indifferent sightseers dropped their voices as they told a newcomer, "You see that carriage over there? That's Mrs. Alexander. They haven't found him yet. She got off the train this morning. Horton met her. She heard it in Boston yesterday, heard the newsboys crying it in the street." At noon, Philip Horton made his way through the crowd with a tray and a tin coffee pot from the camp kitchen. When he reached the carriage, he found Mrs. Alexander just as he had left her in the early morning, leaning forward a little, with her hand on the lowered window, looking at the river. Hour after hour she had been watching the water, the lonely, useless stone towers, and the convulsed mass of iron wreckage over which the angry river continually spat up its yellow foam. "Those poor women out there, do they blame him very much?" she asked, as she handed the coffee cup back to Horton. "Nobody blames him, Mrs. Alexander. If anyone is to blame, I'm afraid it's I. I should have stopped work before he came. He said so as soon as I met him. I tried to get him here a day earlier, but my telegram missed him somehow. He didn't have time, really, to explain to me. If he'd got here on Monday, he'd have had all the men off at once. But, you see, Mrs. Alexander, such a thing never happened before. According to all human calculations, it simply couldn't happen." Horton leaned wearily against the front wheel of the cab. He had not had his clothes off for 30 hours, and the stimulus of violent excitement was beginning to wear off.
Don't be afraid to tell me the worst, Mr. Horton. Don't leave me to the dread of finding out things that people may be saying. If he is blamed, if he needs anyone to speak for him. For the first time her voice broke, and a flush of life, tearful, painful, and confused, swept over her rigid pallor. If he needs anyone, tell me. Show me what to do. She began to sob, and Horton hurried away. When he came back at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he was carrying his hat in his hand, and Winifred knew, as soon as she saw him, that they had found Bartley. She opened the carriage door before he reached her and stepped to the ground. Horton put out his hand as if to hold her back, and spoke pleadingly, "Won't you drive up to my house, Mrs. Alexander? They will take him up there. Take me to him now, please. I shall not make any trouble." The group of men down under the river bank fell back when they saw a woman coming, and one of them threw a tarpaulin over the stretcher. They took off their hats and caps as Winifred approached, and although she had pulled her veil down over her face, they did not look up at her. She was taller than Horton, and some of the men thought she was the tallest woman they had ever seen. "As tall as himself," someone whispered. Horton motioned to the men, and six of them lifted the stretcher and began to carry it up the embankment. Winifred followed them the half-mile to Horton's house. She walked quietly, without once breaking down or stumbling. When the bearers put the stretcher down in Horton's spare bedroom, she thanked them and gave her hand to each in turn. The men went out of the house and through the yard with their caps in their hands. They were too much confused to say anything as they went down the hill. Horton himself was almost as deeply perplexed. "Mamie," he said to his wife when he came out of the spare room half an hour later, "will you take Mrs. Alexander the thing she needs? She is going to do everything herself. Just stay about where you can hear her, and go in if she wants you." Everything happened as Alexander had foreseen in that moment of prescience under the river. With her own hands, she washed him clean of every mark of disaster. All night he was alone with her in the still house, his great head lying deep in the pillow. In the pocket of his coat, Winifred found the letter that he had written her the night before he left New York, water-soaked and illegible, but because of its length, she knew it had been meant for her. For Alexander, death was an easy creditor. Fortune, which had smiled upon him consistently all his life, did not desert him in the end. His harshest critics did not doubt that, had he lived, he would have retrieved himself. Even Lucius Wilson did not see in this accident the disaster he had once foretold. When a great man dies in his prime, there is no surgeon who can say whether he did well, whether or not the future was his, as it seemed to be. The mind that society had come to regard as a powerful and trustworthy machine, dedicated to its service, may for a long time have been sick within itself and bent upon its own destruction. Epilogue. Professor Wilson had been living in London for 6 years, and he was just back from a visit to America. One afternoon, soon after his return, he put on his frock coat and drove in a hansom to pay a call upon Hilda Burgoyne, who still lived at her old number off Bedford Square. He and Miss Burgoyne had been fast friends for a long time. He had first noticed her about the corridors of the British Museum, where he read constantly. Her being there so often had made him feel that he would like to know her, and as she was not an inaccessible person, an introduction was not very difficult. The preliminaries once over, they came to depend a great deal upon each other, and Wilson, after his day's reading, often went round to Bedford Square for his tea. They had much more in common than their memories of a common friend. Indeed, they seldom spoke of him. They saved that for the deep moments which do not come often, and then their talk of him was mostly silence. Wilson knew that Hilda had loved him. More than this, he had not tried to know. It was late when Wilson reached Hilda's apartment on this particular December afternoon, and he found her alone. She sent for fresh tea and made him comfortable, as she had a knack of making people comfortable. "How good you were to come back before Christmas. I quite dreaded the holidays without you. You've helped me over a good many Christmases," she smiled at him gaily. "As if you needed me for that. But at any rate, I needed you. How well you are looking, my dear, and how rested."
He peered up at her from his low chair, balancing the tips of his long fingers together in a judicial manner which had grown on him with years. Hilda laughed as she carefully poured out his cream.
That means I was looking very seedy at the end of the season, doesn't it?
Well, we must show where at last, you know. Wilson took the cup gratefully.
Ah, no need to remind a man of 70, who has just been home to find that he has survived all his contemporaries. I was most gently treated, as a sort of precious relic. But, do you know, it made me feel awkward to be hanging about still.
70? Never mention it to me.
Hilda looked appreciatively at the professor's alert face, with so many kindly lines about the mouth and so many quizzical ones about the eyes.
You've got to hang about for me, you know. I can't even let you go home again. You must stay. Now that I have you back, you're the realest thing I have.
Wilson chuckled.
Dear me, am I? Out of so many conquests and the spoils of conquered cities, you've really missed me? Well, then, I shall hang. Even if you have at last to put me in the mummy room with the others. You'll visit me often, won't you?
Every day in the calendar. Here, your cigarettes are in this drawer where you left them.
She struck a match and lit one for him.
But you did, after all, enjoy being at home again?
Oh, yes. I found the long railway journeys trying. People live 1,000 miles apart. But I did it thoroughly. I was all over the place. It was in Boston I lingered longest.
Ah, you saw Mrs. Alexander?
Often. I dined with her, and had tea there 12 different times, I should think. Indeed, it was to see her that I lingered on and on. I found that I still loved to go to the house. It always seemed as if Bartley were there somehow, and that at any moment one might hear his heavy tramp on the stairs. Do you know, I kept feeling that he must be up in his study.
The professor looked reflectively into the grate.
I should really have liked to go up there. That was where I had my last long talk with him. But Mrs. Alexander never suggested it.
Why?
Wilson was a little startled by her tone, and he turned his head so quickly that his cufflink caught the string of his eyeglasses and pulled them awry.
Why?
What? Dear me, I don't know. She probably never thought of it.
Hilda bit her lip.
I don't know what made me say that. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go on, please, and tell me how it was.
Well, it was like that. Almost as if he were there. In a way, he really is there. She never lets him go. It's the most beautiful and dignified sorrow I've ever known. It's so beautiful that it has its compensations, I should think. Its very completeness is a compensation. It gives her a fixed star to steer by. She doesn't drift. We sat there evening after evening, in the quiet of that magically haunted room, and felt the sunset burn on the river and felt him. Felt him with a difference, of course.
Hilda leaned forward, her elbow on her knee, her chin on her hand.
With a difference? Because of her, you mean?
Wilson's brow wrinkled.
Something like that, yes.
Of course, as time goes on, to her he becomes more and more their simple personal relation.
Hilda studied the droop of the professor's head intently.
You didn't altogether like that? You felt it wasn't wholly fair to him?
Wilson shook himself and readjusted his glasses.
Oh, fair enough. More than fair. Of course, I always felt that my image of him was just a little different from hers. No relation is so complete that it can hold absolutely all of a person. And I liked him just as he was. His deviations, too. The places where he didn't square.
Hilda considered vaguely. Has she grown much older? She asked at last.
Yes and no. In a tragic way, she is even handsomer, but colder. Cold for everything but him. Forget thyself to marble, I kept thinking of that. Her happiness was a happiness à deux, not apart from the world, but actually against it. And now her grief is like that. She saves herself for it, and doesn't even go through the form of seeing people much. I'm sorry. It would be better for her, and might be so good for them, if she could let other people in.
Perhaps she's afraid of letting him out a little, of sharing him with somebody.
Wilson put down his cup, and looked up with vague alarm.
Dear me, it takes a woman to think of that now. I don't, you know, think we ought to be hard on her. More, even, than the rest of us, she didn't choose her destiny. She underwent it, and it has left her chilled. As to her not wishing to take the world into her confidence, well, it is a pretty brutal and stupid world, after all, you know.
Hilda leaned forward,
Yes, I know, I know. Only I can't help being glad that there was something for him, even in stupid and vulgar people. My little Marie worshipped him. When she is dusting, I always know when she has come to his picture. Wilson nodded. Oh, yes. He left an echo. The ripples go on in all of us. He belonged to the people who make the play, and most of us are only onlookers at the best. We shouldn't wonder too much at Mrs. Alexander. She must feel how useless it would be to go about, that she may as well sit still, that nothing can happen to her after Bartley. Yes, said Hilda softly. Nothing can happen to one after Bartley. They both sat looking into the fire. End of Chapter 10 and Epilogue, and End of Alexander's Bridge by Willa Sibert Cather. Recorded in Los Angeles, California, December 2008.
Save big this holiday season, all in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.